Howard Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated. Good morning. We have two cases set for oral argument today. The first case that's in front of us is State of South Dakota versus Theodore Guzman. On behalf of the appellant defendant, we have Connor Duffy, who's present and arguing. And on behalf of the State of South Dakota, we have Chelsea Wenzel, who is present and will be arguing on behalf of the state. Each side will have 20 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Duffy, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. With that, you may proceed with your argument, Mr. Duffy.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, justices. Probably the most important fact of this entire appeal is that as to the second trial, there was no sequestration order. As we discuss the sequestration order today, as the state writes the sequestration order in their brief, I want to remind this court that that is entirely hypothetical.
Does the sequestration order, counsel, from the first trial carry over?
Absolutely not, Justice Curran. And I believe that the opinion in State v. Janisse, it is a concurring opinion by a single justice, but I believe that the line in there that all orders must be anew. Also, the statute SDCL, I apologize. There is a statute that says that when you have a new trial, all evidence must be presented anew. So I don't believe that the sequestration order from the first trial applied in this trial.
When you say all evidence must be presented anew, how does that equate to an indication that all, are you suggesting all orders, that all the issues need to be represented to the court and new orders entered?
That was my demand in this trial, that because I was a new attorney on the case, that I needed the state to file all of their notices and their motions again so that I could be informed of those. And yes, I do believe that is the case. I do believe that the way that the statute has been interpreted by this court would suggest that something like a sequestration order from the first trial would not apply to the second trial.
But where in the record does it reflect that you made that demand that you just referred to?
It is from a pretrial motions hearing.
I don't want you to spend your time looking for that.
Justice, I said in the pretrial motions hearing, I said, and on that point, it's my position that the state needs to file all of its motions again and file all of its notices again. I can't be expected to abide by the court's ruling, some of them oral, on issues that were litigated by a different attorney a year before I even met Teddy.
There was some discussion at the time that the motion was made to exclude this witness that I don't remember the exact phrase, but I think you made the comment, or defense counsel, I assume it was you, made the comment, something to the effect of, yes, she may have been in there for a bit or something like that. Timing of when did you learn of that, and is that in the record in terms of when you found out your client had sat? And I know the rooms are separate, and because of COVID, it complicated things. When did that transpire?
Yes, Chief Justice Jessen, thank you for that question. This was about 36 hours before the in-chambers meeting where I said that. I went to the Guzman house. I had some witnesses who had been dodging me. We had been in trial all day. We'd been in trial for days. It was about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and I had three witnesses who had agreed to meet me through the grapevine at the Guzman house. I was sitting at the kitchen table. Helen and Benny, my client's parents, were present. The witnesses, some of them did show up. I was interviewing them at the kitchen table. And Benny, my client's father, made mention that he had been in the viewing room. He'd also said that he didn't want to testify and he wanted to watch the trial. And he'd said that to me before. I don't know exactly what was said at that kitchen table, but it became clear to me that Helen had gone into that viewing room with him. And I don't know what I said, but I said either, oh, Helen, you can't watch the trial yet, or, oh, Helen, you can't go into that room.
But that was all after the fact, after they'd already been in the courtroom.
Yes, and that was about approximately, in my estimation, approximately 36 hours before we had that in-chambers meeting. And that's a good point, because looking back on that, I could see how you can't watch the trial yet, or you can't be in that room, could have been misinterpreted by her. That room changed locations. There were two different viewing rooms. And you can't watch the trial yet may have meant to her that she couldn't be in the courtroom, because this trial had already occurred once before under normal conditions. And once she was done testifying, she had watched the remainder of the trial.
Tell me about the, if you could please, the impact in your view of Helen's testimony. And of course, we have the advantage of her testimony from knowing what her testimony is or would likely be from the first trial. Why, in your view, if there's error in any number of theories, one, because maybe there wasn't an order, or because it was an abuse of discretion, even if there was an order, why is it so important to the case? Why would its exclusion be so prejudicial?
That's a good question, Justice Salter. Partly it's highly prejudicial because the jury was told in opening statements that his mother was present in the house. Then the jury didn't hear from his mother. That may have made them think that they believed my client's mother thought he was a child rapist. But the most important thing, and this goes to the harmless error analysis, which I'm sure this court will be conducting, harmless error, because of the constitutional implications of this, it must be found beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't think, because when Helen was allowed to testify, there was no conviction. When she was excluded from testifying, there was a conviction. That might sound a little bit glib, but to me, that gives me a doubt as to whether or not Helen's testimony affected the result of the second trial. And it's also very important when reviewing her testimony from the first trial, which was incoherent in some places, that we not think of Helen's testimony that it was going to be identical in the second trial. The most important thing about Helen's testimony in the second trial, well, is that it didn't happen, but that I wasn't allowed to direct her. The attorney who directed her in the first trial did not do a very good job. You'll see it. It's absolutely disastrous direct examination of Helen, and it would have been significantly different had she been directed by me.
If it covered the same topics, then that would have been available for impeachment purposes.
Absolutely. And that's a very good point, because there was no way that Helen's testimony ever could have been tailored or tainted by what she saw.
I also wanted to make sure I clearly understood your on this issue of whether there was a prejudicial effect of not being able to call her. The proffer you made to the court related solely to her being there on the night that AC's incident occurred. Is that accurate? That was what you presented to the court, that it would be very limited to that.
That is correct.
Okay. Also, it did not appear to me anywhere in the record of the second trial and when this issue was being addressed that you raised a constitutional claim on behalf of your client. So tell us, is there an issue then on appeal as to whether or not you preserved that claim, and if not, why not?
I don't believe that there is any issue as to whether or not I preserved the claim. I presented an alternative remedy, which was to have Helen testify. I made it very clear to the court what I wanted to happen. I don't believe that, and I laid out in my response from when this issue arose to when the judge ruled on it was less than 3 hours, and it was filled with nonstop trial tasks. There was no time for me to consult anything, to come up with case law, or explain to the judge which amendments of the Constitution, the 5th, 14th, and 6th, that this violated. I think under those circumstances, my failure to object at all could be excused. But I made clear to the court what I wanted. It is it has obvious constitutional implications, and I don't think that my failure to recite case law on the spot or cite to the Constitution when I was doing that is fatal to here.
The other thing that it appeared to me from the record is when the court, at the end of the discussion with the court made it clear that it would not allow Benny to testify, but seemed to leave open the opportunity to revisit the issue of whether or not the court would allow Helen to testify.
It did seem that way, but then he didn't. We came back into chambers and he just ruled on it. And I noticed that as well, Justice, when he said, well, if she'd been in there for an hour or two, that'd be a different story. And once we took the testimony and it was determined that she had only been in there for the testimony of a single witness, that was the testimony that we took in chambers. That still didn't change his mind.
It also appeared that you were operating under the understanding that there was a sequestration order for this second trial.
That's correct.
And so at any time, did you suggest to the trial court, well, there is no sequestration order here?
No, I was operating under instinct and under the assumption that there was an order. I don't think that's relevant. I don't think that I, as a defense attorney, cannot speak an order into existence, and I cannot assume an order into existence.
Well, where it may be relevant is in terms of what arguments you presented to the court below, because we're reviewing whether or not the circuit court erred in what was presented to the circuit court in issuing its ruling at that trial. Wouldn't it?
Again, no, I don't believe that it would. I think that I made myself clear what I wanted to do, and then as a defendant, I was disallowed the opportunity to put a witness on the stand. I think that's such a serious and obvious Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment violation that I didn't need to cite case law or even cite to the Constitution. I just made known what I wanted to happen, and I was not allowed to do that.
Mr. Duffy, I understand your position on prejudice, and thank you for your answer to that. You know, the idea of Helen testifying was previewed or foreshadowed, and so the absence of her testimony may create difficulties. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the evidence itself, which I think we've discussed already this morning. You suggested was going to be for a very limited purpose, right? She was going to say she had her door open and she didn't hear anything. Is it significant at all, or should we find it significant at all if we get to this point where we're assessing prejudice that the two other girls besides AC who were in the room, mainly NG, who was kind of testified, she was kind of aware something was going on, but she didn't know what was going on. And she really didn't report hearing anything either. She reported some things that she saw, but it seemed to me when I read her direct examination, was pretty candid and said, yeah, I really don't. I had a bad feeling. It looked kind of, this isn't her words, but suspicious or whatever, but she didn't talk about hearing anything. She just talked about something that gave her some concern. But when she was questioned, even on direct examination before your cross, she said, yeah, I don't know for sure what happened. So if that's the quantum of the evidence from, or a sampling of the evidence, I should say, from the girls that were in there with AC, how does Helen's testimony add appreciably to the defense theory in this case?
I think that, as we all know, children can be very heavy sleepers. I think that the jury probably considered that. I think as well that Helen's testimony in the first trial was that she went to sleep between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning and that she had her door open. And I think that those things, an adult not hearing this and being awake until, I think the kids went to bed much earlier than that. She was awake later, and her door was open. She's an adult, and she was testified that she heard nothing. And so I think that she had testimony that was not duplicative of anything that was testified to.
I want to let you get to your other issues, including the duplicity one. But before I go, let you go, because your time's going, and I'm sorry we're taking a lot of it, but before I let you go, do you agree with me that even if there were error, preserved or otherwise, and it was found to be not harmless or not prejudicial, required correction, it would only really apply to the conviction dealing with AC?
No, don't agree with you on that, Justice. I think that, as I noted in my reply brief that although it's an analogy to the case that I cited in my reply brief, that one, just because the jury is instructed not to allow, not to consider each count separately, that doesn't mean that a jury is not prejudiced by having multiple counts in front of them. And I don't think that the instruction saved them from that prejudice. But I also believe that just common sense, that his two daughters denied anything happened during a forensic interview. And that's not a non-disclosure.
But how does Helen's testimony impact any of that?
Because if it, the jury, AC is who is the catalyst. AC is the one who didn't deny. AC is the one who came forward. If they believe AC, they believe the daughters. AC's testimony impacted everything. And AC's testimony is the testimony that Helen would be saying she didn't hear anything. So Helen's testimony was relevant to AC. AC's testimony then certainly impacted the other girls, because the other girls denied that anything happened during a forensic interview. That's actually quite rare. It's not non-disclosure. That is, in direct questions by a forensic interview, it's actually quite rare for them to deny over and over again. And so the case just was not as strong against the two daughters as it was with AC.
When did LG deny in a forensic interview?
LG, they both denied in their first forensic interviews. I'm not sure when exactly those dates occurred, but both LG and NG made explicit denials in their first forensic interviews.
You've argued, if I could transition you, because I want to get your answer on this, you've argued that the trial court erred or abused its discretion by allowing the testimony of your client from the first trial, with the argument being that your client was somehow compelled, or I think you used the verb impelled, to go and testify in the first trial because of duplicitous evidence. Connect that up for me, because it seems to me that if there is duplicitous evidence at all, I'm trying to think about why that would prompt a defendant to testify, unless the defendant was going to testify, well, this allegation is righteous and this one is not, which the defendant surely will not, and which your client did not. So what's the relationship between having duplicitous evidence and your assertion that the response to that was to testify?
That connection is not as strong as some of my other issues. And I think you're right to bring that up. I think the connection there is just that things aren't going so well for me. There's a lot of evidence against me. I better take the stand in my own defense.
Okay.
And that's about all I've got for you on that. But back to issue number one, which I think everybody understands is my ringer here. This, even under a trial that is tried under normal circumstances, ordinary circumstances, with an explicit, clear order, what happened here would not merit exclusion of Helen's testimony. And this is far from an ordinary trial. I think most of you are lucky enough to be appointed to this bench before you had to try a case under COVID restrictions. And I've done it a few times now. I don't like it. We picked the jury in a horse barn full of horse manure with face shields and the Britney Spears concert-type microphone. I mean, the viewing rooms, the media was in complaining that they couldn't hear anything in those viewing rooms. They're not pleasant, these COVID trials, and this was far from an ordinary trial, in addition to the fact that there was no order, much less an explicit order. There's also this sort of false equivalency between the exclusion of a defense's witness and the exclusion of a prosecution's witness. And again, as you all know, this is an issue of first impression in South Dakota. And I believe that the judge made that error. Basically, his entire reasoning was contained in this statement, his entire legal reasoning. Mr. Duffy, I don't think you'd tolerate it if the state violated that rule. I think the rule is the same for both parties in this matter. And that's absolutely not the case. The rule is not the same for my client as it is for the state. As the state puts in their brief. Indeed, the state is entitled to a fair trial, too. And that's a snappy slogan, but there's no citation to that. It is not the same thing. The fair trial that my client is entitled to is backed up by the Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the Sixth Amendment. The fair trial that the state is entitled to is a much more nebulous concept. And the what's good for the goose is good for the gander type of reasoning under this situation doesn't work. The reason this is an issue of first impression in South Dakota is because it's likely never happened. The reason it's likely never happened is because it shouldn't. State v. Holder, for 129 years, U.S. v. Holder has counseled that you're not supposed to do this. The sanctions, the statement from State v. or from Holder v. U.S., if a witness disobeys the order of withdrawal, while he may be proceeded against for contempt and his testimony is open to comment to the jury by reason of his conduct, he is not thereby disqualified.
Your time's up, Mr. Kelton. Oh. But you'll have a rebuttal.
Thank you.
You may proceed, Ms. Winslow.
May it please the court, counsel. In April of 2021, the defendant in this case was convicted of raping his two adolescent daughters, NG and LG, and their friend, AC. The defendant was also convicted of engaging in sexual contact with one of his daughters. Their friend was the first one to report the defendant raped her. This rape occurred when she stayed with defendant's daughters at their grandma's house. The grandmother was Helen Guzman, and that's defendant's mother. The daughters and their friend AC, along with several other children, slept in the living room. Numerous adults were home at this time, including Helen and defendant's sister Nicole. Now, in his first trial on these charges, both Helen and Nicole testified regarding the night of the sleepover. In the first trial, the court granted defense's witness for a reciprocal sequestration order, and there was no reported violations. Now, the first trial ended in a mistrial due to a hung jury. In the second trial, the witness sequestration order did carry over. And indeed, defendant relied on that order.
Why did it carry over?
So, first to make a comment about what defendant's argument is, all of the evidence must be produced anew. There's no rule that all of the motions must be produced anew, and a trial court may rely on the same motions.
Was there a written order of sequestration from the first trial, or was it just done orally, as often is the case?
No, there was a written motion from defendant and a written order granting that motion as well.
If the court had, let's say, a preliminary determination or a hearing of some sort, like a suppression hearing, to resolve a motion to exclude evidence, and the court granted a request by one of the parties to sequester witnesses during that preliminary type hearing, would that order carry over to the trial, or would the court need to enter a new trial order sequestering witnesses?
I think that would depend on how the parties relied on it and whether anyone requested it be carried over to the trial. In this case,
let's say nobody requested it, and they kind of thought it was there, but they really didn't know. Does that control every proceeding, every time when the parties and the judge get together in court for the rest of the proceeding period?
Not necessarily, but here it did, and here's why. Because the defendant in the March 25th pretrial hearing in the second trial, the defense counsel specifically relied on the order from the first trial. In this case, he relied on the court's order keeping the witnesses apart and asked that it be applied to the state at trial. So here there's no question that there was a written order in the first trial, and it was defendant's motion and order in the first trial, and that he relied on it in the second trial. I understand defense counsels were different, but this defense counsel did rely on it in the second trial and asked for it to be applied to the state. So the second trial was 5 days long. It went from Thursday to Wednesday. And on the fifth and last day, defendant called Helen Guzman as a witness. The state asked for her to be excluded because she violated the witness sequestration order that was still in place. Defense counsel admitted he knew that Helen was in there, but obviously requested that she testify anyway. He did not present a constitutional argument to the court, nor did he talk about the importance of Helen's testimony.
So would we bifurcate the review on that? Should we, what would we do? If we agree with the view that the constitutional claim was forfeited, we could still review that for plain error.
Yes. You may. In this instance, neither party requested it, but obviously this court may do that.
But let's say you would pair that one off, and then what? Review the discretionary call about whether to exclude the witness or not for an abuse of discretion, and split the review up that way.
To be frank, I did wrestle with this a lot in preparing my brief for this, and I think the answer to that is that whether there's a constitutional issue or not, it's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. If this court would want to review it for plain error because there was no constitutional issue raised, the state would be, I guess, fine with that, or if the court did not want to find that that wasn't preserved. But in both cases, the importance is defendant has the requirement to prove prejudice. I know in his argument, defense counsel talked about harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That's when there's a constitutional violation and the state has the burden of proving prejudice. Here, whether it's the abuse of discretion or plain error, that falls onto the defendant to prove prejudice. And also, it's the state's position that for plain error, the standard for showing prejudice is higher than it is for that on the abuse of discretion. So this court could rely on the abuse of discretion if they preferred.
Can we address that question of prejudice? He's contending that his client was acquitted in the first trial where Helen did testify and convicted in the second, pointing to that as explicit evidence of prejudice.
I'm not aware of any case from this court or any other court saying that different verdicts means that there was prejudice in the first trial. And in the second trial, we had 12 different unbiased jurors. There was 404B evidence in the first trial, and there was different counsel in a different argument. There was a lot of different things that changed in the second trial, so I don't think, or it's the state's position, that there's no prejudice that can be presumed from that.
Well, how technical do you think we have to get on reviewing constitutional, whether a constitutional issue has been raised? I mean, the defendant gets up and says, hey, you're going to exclude this witness. I object to that. I think that's improper. I mean, I think we all understand defense has an opportunity and the right in the Constitution to submit witnesses and to put their case on. That's constitutional. It's a little different than the state when you exclude. So maybe it's plain error, but does the defendant have to get up and say, Sixth Amendment violation, Your Honor? Or is it enough to say, Your Honor, I'm entitled to put this witness on, and it's going to really prejudice my case if you don't put it on?
It's the state's position that defense counsel does have to make that Sixth Amendment argument, but additionally, defense counsel didn't say that it was going to be prejudicial if Helen wasn't put on. So we don't even have that fact in this case.
So you said the Sixth Amendment has to make a. What if a lawyer just says, "Hey, Judge, this isn't fair," or you can glean that from the record. Is that enough to sort of say implicate notions of fundamental, fairness, which we kind of roughly equate to due process? Is that enough?
No.
You have to say due process, or you have to say the due process clause, or.
At the very least, you either have to say that there was a constitutional violation or give the reasoning for a constitutional violation so this court has something to review.
But what if the complaint is just one that strikes at the notion of fairness? So let's say, for instance, let's change gears. What if it's a suppression issue again, let's say, and a lawyer raises the issue, doesn't say boo about the Fourth Amendment, but says, it was unreasonable. They shouldn't have seized that. That was unreasonable. Doesn't say the Fourth Amendment, doesn't say anything like that. Is that enough to raise a Fourth Amendment issue?
According to this court's decision in Willingham, no. In Willingham, a constitutional argument was raised, but it was a different raised for a different basis before the trial court. And on appeal, this court said that the basis for the Fourth Amendment violation was different. I believe it was Fourth Amendment, was different, and therefore it was failed to be preserved for review. That argument was failed to be preserved. And here we have the same issue. The argument was not made to the trial court. And in looking at whether the trial court abused its discretion in the decision they made, this court does look to the information that the trial court had when they made that decision. And as we've talked about, the same arguments were not presented. Helen's testimony was described as limited, and there was no suggestion that she was the only witness for defense, and the court couldn't have known at the time that they ruled. The court said that they wanted to go back and review Helen's testimony from the first trial. Right after Helen testified, Nicole testified, and Nicole was properly noticed as a witness in the second trial. The importance of Helen's testimony was also not shown to the trial court, and that, I think, is the fatal flaw here, or one of the fatal flaws, because the importance of the testimony is what makes it rise to a constitutional violation. If this was not crucial, there was no constitutional violation.
So let's say the defendant says everything else is the same, but the defendant more expressly says, or defense counsel says more expressly, this is unfair, and it violates my client's right to present a complete defense or have a fair trial. How does the addition of that to the objection place the trial court judge in a better position to rule more accurately? How does it change the outlook of the trial court judge in any way by the addition of that sort of additional clause?
Well, if the trial court here had heard that this was going to be defendant's only witness, or if he had heard the same arguments about the importance of her testimony, I think he could have better balanced the defendant.
That's the merits of the call. I'm just saying in terms of whether it's preserved or not preserved. Mm-hmm. So he expressly invokes in some way, shape, or form notions of due process. How does that change the trial court's analysis? Nothing else changes, just that. How is the trial court in a better or different position to rule than would be the case without that clause?
At that point, a constitutional violation may well be preserved. I can't say for sure, of course, for the record, but it may be preserved in that instance. But that's, again, not what we have here. And the trial court didn't have, I guess, the ability. You know, counsel talks about not having time to come up with a different argument. Trial courts are in the very same position. It is the state's position that counsel did have time, and he didn't ask for any more time, which is another different thing. But the trial court didn't have time either. Trial courts or trial judges have to rule with the information they're given at the time that they're given it. So giving more information or giving more argument is going to help that trial court make a better decision.
Counsel, can you address the argument that was made pertaining to the holding in the Holder case that goes back many, many years, that refers to the weight of the authority being that you would not ordinarily be excluded just on the ground of sequestration, and that there are other ways to deal with that? The court there referred to there being cases where there are particular circumstances, though, where this may be an appropriate remedy in the discretion of the court. Assuming it's your view that this presented such a case, what were the particular circumstances in this case that you believe made this a sound exercise of the court's discretion here?
Yes. So in response to the Holder case, several circuit courts of appeal, a plethora of state Supreme Courts have said that if defendant or his counsel knew or consented, connived, procured, or knew about the violation, that is something that raises the violation, to a different level, or where exclusion would be proper. And again, that is what we have here. Before the trial court and before this court, defense counsel admitted that he knew Helen was violating. Today, we learned that it might have been on Monday night. Well, Helen still went into the into the viewing room on Tuesday. So there was still a violation, whether that's on counsel or her, the record does not reflect. But there was still a violation, and counsel knew about the violations. So that is one instance where courts have said that exclusion is proper. And one of those comes from this court, I believe, is an early 1900s case, and it is in my brief, but this court has spoken on that issue as well. And it's consistent with the other courts of appeals and state courts who have also said that.
Is that enough, or does there also have to be some connection between what may have been heard or observed by the witness violating the sequestration order, and then how that relates to that witness's proffered testimony?
It's the state's position that that would be enough, but in this case, we do have a second reason as well, and that is the reason. Here, whatever day Helen was in the viewing rooms, especially if there were multiple, there were witnesses on each of those days that talked about the facts of the case that she was going to talk about as well. And that is what causes prejudice to the state. That's what that's one of the main problems here, too, because that's the point of a witness sequestration order, is to keep witnesses from tailoring their testimony based on the testimony of others.
Well,
so,
but your prejudice argument's a little weak here, where you've already tried the case once. You've heard these same witnesses. You've seen all the cross-examination. You've really had sort of a dry run, so to speak, of the case. And now you're back in front of the court again, essentially presenting the same witnesses, same evidence. How is there prejudice to the state in an instance like that to have... And again, I'm not suggesting you violate the order, but nonetheless, the prejudice doesn't seem very strong to me in that instance.
The state is still prejudiced, and the state is entitled to a fair trial as well. And it's not just the state's interest, I guess, that goes to that prejudice, because, A, the court
has... What's the specific prejudice here? Second time through the trial, yep. You've heard all this before. She heard it all before. She had a chance to review the transcripts if she wanted to. What's the specific prejudice to the state here in letting her testify?
If she changes her testimony to look more credible, in the first trial, her testimony was inconsistent with defendant. So if she comes back in and makes her testimony more consistent and then brings in further testimony saying she didn't wake up, she looks more credible to the jury. And that's what the problem is. It's not just prejudice to the state, it's prejudice to the system. Witness sequestration orders are in place so the jury can fulfill their truth.
But she already had the opportunity to do that the first trial, because she sat through that whole thing. She could have tailored her testimony without sitting through any of the second trial. Agreed?
Yes. I guess here we were lucky enough to know that she did in this case, instead of speculating whether she could have or would have. But at the end of the day, it does go to prejudice. And prejudice was a big thing that was brought up with defense's argument as well. And here there was no prejudice. First, the defendant has a right to a fundamental right to present a defense, but he still has to follow the same rules a procedure designed, right? Here, this is a rule. It's a well-settled rule. The state has a strong interest, and that interest is only outweighed, and a constitutional issue or the exclusion of evidence only rises to the level of a constitutional issue if it was critical evidence. Critical evidence, according to the United States Supreme Court, is when the only witness at the scene with defendant was excluded, or when highly exculpatory evidence was excluded. This court has said that there's no violation if the witness that was excluded or the testimony was not the only witness or not the only avenue for this information. And here, this evidence was not crucial. She wasn't the only witness. Helen was not the only witness. Defendant had an opportunity to explore, and that's what he's entitled to have, an opportunity to present a defense. He had the opportunity to explore with NG and LG, who were present during the sleepover. And if it was material, it was only slightly so. Again, it does not rise to the level of a constitutional violation. Defendant said there was a change in AC's testimony from the first to the second trial. There wasn't. She testified that she cried, and there was no suggestion that it was loud. Also, I think it's important to look at the fact that this was a small subset of defendant's defense. He has a right to present a defense. And here he was still first, still able to argue that AC was noisy and that nobody woke up, and two, he was able to present the other parts of his defense. His defense was a blanket denial. These were fabricated allegations. It was because of the apparatus, and he established that through other witnesses, other avenues, cross-examination of all of the victims, of the forensic interviewers. He was able to put on an unnoticed witness. So he did have the opportunity to present a defense. There was no constitutional violation in this issue. Helen's testimony was not critical, and he still had the opportunity to put on his entire defense. To the extent that this court would be interested in applying plain error review, we don't have that here. As defense says, it's an issue of first impression in this state, and this court has said there's no plain error when neither the Supreme Court nor this court has resolved the issue beyond debate. Holder has said it's up to the states to decide of the appropriate times to exclude a witness. There was no prejudice, again, and this is not the exceptional circumstance that this court normally uses plain error for. This was not an innocent mistake, and this is just not the case that would be the exceptional circumstance. The state's entitled to a fair trial, and so is the defendant, but he is not entitled to a perfect one. And here, defendant was given two fair trials, and he was appropriately convicted. Thank you.
Mr. Duffy, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
The site I was trying to find, I apologize, State v. Janisse, 321 Northwest 2nd, 527. It's a 1982 South Dakota case. Rulings of the court at the former trial are not binding on the court at the second trial. Again, that is a concurring opinion by a lone justice. The statute, SDCL 23A-29-2, the granting of a new trial places the parties in the same position as if no trial had been had. Now, I thought that what was especially telling about the state's argument is that, and in their brief, in the first trial, Helen had no issue complying with the sequestration order. Exactly. In the first trial, this was an ordinary trial, not subject to these sort of confusing COVID regulations, and she did have no trouble complying with the order. I think that shows that she wanted to be in compliance and that this was a mistake on her part, that she wasn't conniving. And I think we also have to draw a line between knowledge and connivance and consent from those very old cases, with the connivance, consent, or knowledge of the witness or his counsel. That knowledge, in every case, you have knowledge eventually, just like I did. I had knowledge after the fact. But that doesn't rise to the level of connivance or consent, and particularly under these circumstances.
How do you respond? I believe the argument was made by your opposing counsel that even if you became aware the night or two before this came up before the court and gave some direction that she stay out of the room, that she still went back into the room, then how do you consider that fact in the mix? And that seemed to be supported by the testimony that the state's attorney put on from its paralegal.
I don't know if she deliberately disobeyed me. I don't know if she was mistaken about what I had told her. Again, like I said, that room, you can't go in that room or you can't watch the trial yet. If she was mistaken or if she deliberately disobeyed me, I don't know. I also don't think it's entirely clear that she was in after I told her that. I think that I told her about 36 hours prior, and the testimony seems to be that she was in there the day before, but I'm not certain on that either.
You know, it's interesting. I've had this thought along the way as I've worked on the case, and your comments prompted me to think about it again. We really don't know a lot about whatever this was by way of a violation or viewing or whatever you want to call it. And I know it kind of came up quickly, and it's dealt with in only a matter of pages as the state kind of prepares to wind up and wrap up its case. But was there anything that prohibited, was Helen there? Was there anything that prohibited the court or a party from saying, hey, let's hear from Helen. Let's figure out how bad this was or if it was bad at all. I realize that some revision of history because that didn't happen, but was there some impediment to that? Is there some reason why that didn't happen?
I didn't request it. I can answer the question.
Well, I'm not playing blame. I'm just saying, was she there? Was it?
She was there. She was out in the hallway as they were talking about on the record.
It would have resolved a lot, I suppose. Again, looking back on it.
Well, when Judge Mandel said, well, she'd been in there for an hour or two, that might change my opinion, and then it came that she had only viewed the testimony of a single witness, and he still excluded her. So I don't know what would have changed Judge Mandel's mind in this case. The state said that I relied on the order, as if that made this order valid, this imaginary order valid. That was, as she said, that was weeks or possibly 3 weeks before trial. That was anticipatory. I said, I don't want anybody violating this court's order, keeping them apart, assuming that an order would be either orally put on the record or signed. And those witnesses that we were discussing were actually in the courtroom. They were not in viewing rooms. So we were discussing, and I said order keeping them apart. So that doesn't necessarily mean a sequestration order, although I will tell the court that I did think there was a sequestration order in place here. I always do, because there's every trial I've ever had, there's been a sequestration order. And again, I think the fact that she had no trouble in the first trial, Helen had no issue complying with the sequestration order, is really telling that they're making my argument for me in that case. Also, I want to refer.
There was never any discussion anywhere in the pretrial leading up to the second trial about, hey, Judge, are we going to sequester witnesses here? Are we keeping what? Other than the one reference the state made that you made the comment about state. We're going to keep witnesses apart, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. There was no motion made for sequestration, oral or written, by either side. There was no oral order announced in the courtroom or at any time during a pretrial conference. And there was no written motion or order at any point during the second trial. And as I said before, I cannot assume or speak an order into existence. And it's very telling that the only record in the second trial of any sequestration order is my saying, I don't want them violating the court's order keeping them apart. And I want to call the court's attention to the Melendez case. I think it's extremely important, even though it's only persuasive authority from Colorado, People v. Melendez. They lay out three factors. They call them the PRG factors. We haven't adopted those in our state, but they are very helpful. One of the first factors is involvement of the party or counsel in violation, the witness's actions or state of mind in violating the order, and three, the relationship between the subject matter of the violation and the disobedient witness's testimony. And here we don't have that. We don't have that. The state's made my argument for me on that case when they say that Mr. Guzman was not prejudiced by the exclusion as to two counts. There is no relationship between what Helen saw in the testimony of her granddaughter and her testimony. And those three factors, they determine whether or not sanctions should be imposed at all. You have to consider, though, in Colorado anyway, you have to consider those factors before you determine if a sanction should be imposed at all. And the sanction should be either cross-examination on the violation or contempt. It should almost never be complete exclusion, even of a prosecution's witness, but absolutely, certainly, of a defense witness. And I think the court has to ask itself, how could watching LG's testimony have influenced Helen's testimony? What could she have heard from LG that would have caused her to tailor or change her testimony in any way? And the answer is nothing, absolutely nothing. And if she would have, they'd have had a transcript to immediately impeach her. At State v. Randall, it's just a 2018 case, pretty recent, where they said you have to show prejudice here. You have to show that the order of the exclusion of that witness testimony would have prejudiced them, would have prejudiced and one side or the other. And there, just as in Randall, there has been no showing by the state that there was prejudice, but that there was even the possibility of prejudice from what Helen saw and given her testimony. And again, I disagree with the state that this, I believe this court would have to find, if you wanted to find harmless error, that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of the constitutional implications.
Were you able to present the core of your argument even without Helen's testimony? And the state's argued that any prejudice to your client is minimal because you were able to present the apparatus theory of the case and to present your entire argument through other witnesses. Can you address that?
Yes. The witness that they continually reference, Nicole, the sister, that's one of the witnesses that I had gone over that night to meet, who was dodging me. One of the witnesses, Mr. Guzman's girlfriend, had a warrant for arrest. Nicole was very hesitant to testify. I had gotten an investigator to go to her work and talk to her, but she kept canceling meetings with me, not showing up, and I thought tonight's the night I'm going to get to talk to Nicole because she had testified in the first trial. But the fact is she wasn't really available to testify in the second trial. The nature of a case like this makes witnesses very hesitant. There's a lot of backlash, and she didn't want to testify.
Did you make that fact known to the court when the court left open the possibility of reconsidering whether to allow Helen to testify and indicated something to the effect that unless I hear something else, this is my ruling? So when you, if it became apparent you had no other witness to testify to this fact, why didn't you make that known to the court?
Again, I think it's pretty clear from the less than 3 hours that we had that were filled with nonstop trial tasks that there wouldn't have been any time at all for that. Also, I wasn't thinking about Nicole, and here's why. Because if you go back and you look at Nicole's testimony from the first trial, it's pretty clear that she's discussing a different sleepover. She's adamant in her testimony that the sleepover she's referring to happened before school started.
You're talking about Helen?
The Nicole, the witness that everybody's saying, you should have called Nicole so that she would have testified to the same thing. When Nicole testified in the first trial, her testimony was about a different sleepover, and nobody really realized that. She was insistent that that sleepover happened before school started. This sleepover happened in November. She wasn't a witness that even had knowledge, much less be available.
Do you have any follow-up on that, Justice DeMaine?
Well, my recollection is that it was Helen that was adamant this happened before school started in the first trial.
We'll have to have some clerks look at the record then, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your time's up. Thank you for your arguments in the case from both counsel and good briefs.
Thank you.
That will conclude the case, and we'll be in recess for 10 minutes.